From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, search for missing Malaysian flight intensifies, as do questions. Families fear the worst on missing Malaysia plane. China National Party Congress delegates looking to change their image. These stories and more in this Monday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. It has been more than a day and a half since Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 vanished on its way to Beijing, and the fate of the more than 200 people on board is still unknown. A massive search and rescue is underway in waters off the coast of Malaysia and Vietnam, where the plane presumably crashed. VOA's Bill Ide reports from Beijing that as the hours pass, there are more questions than answers about what happened.
Malaysian authorities say an expansive and intensive search for the plane is underway with support from four other countries, including China and the United States. Authorities say some 40 ships and 22 planes are helping out. Much of the focus so far has been on waters off of Vietnam's southwestern coast, where a large oil slick has been spotted. But now Malaysian authorities say the search effort has extended to land and sea off the western Malaysian coast near Penang. Royal Malaysian Air Force Chief Rozali Daud.
We look back at the recording and there is an indication, possible indication, that the aircraft made a turn back. And this is, collaborated at the moment. As we speak, we are trying to make sense of this and is in some part collaborated by civil radar.
Aviation safety experts say the possibility that the plane turned back at cruising altitude suggests that something had gone wrong and that it may have been trying to make an emergency landing. At a news conference Sunday afternoon, Malaysia Airlines told families to expect the worst while stressing that search and rescue efforts continue. The airline is making arrangements to take family members to Malaysia by Monday morning at the earliest. Malaysia Airlines says a disaster recovery specialist from the United States will be assisting the carrier. It is also setting up command centers in Malaysia's Kota Baru and Vietnam's Ho Chi Minh City. The revelation that two of the passengers on board were using stolen passports and questions about the identity of two others has even raised concerns that the flight's disappearance was the result of a terrorist act. Authorities in Italy and Austria have confirmed that two passengers who were thought to have been on the flight were not, but both had their passports stolen in the past 2 years. Malaysian Transport Minister Hishamuddin Hussein, who is also the country's defense minister, says he has spoken with international intelligence agencies about the four names.
I am in touch with the international intelligence agencies. At the same time, our own intelligence have been activated. And of course, the counterterrorism units, CTIs and CTUs, from all the relevant countries have been informed. And that's what I've been doing since yesterday.
Hussein says terrorism is not the sole focus of the investigation at this point and adds that authorities are not ruling out any possibilities. Authorities say they are reviewing security footage in the airport of the two individuals who boarded the plane using stolen passports. Analysts say that while Asian airport security is not as tight as it is in Europe or the United States, the possibility that as many as four passengers got on board using stolen documents will raise some difficult questions. No group or organization has come forward to claim responsibility for the plane's disappearance. Authorities in China will be watching the investigation closely. The plane was headed to Beijing at a time of already heightened security in the capital. Last week, China's leaders began key annual political meetings in Beijing. Airline safety experts say it is unusual for a plane to crash after reaching cruising altitude. Daniel Zhang is the founder and chief analyst at Aspire Aviation.
Most incidents or accidents take place during takeoff or landings when it is the most dangerous part of the entire duration of the flight, because during takeoff and landings, there are so many factors, and you could have one-way overruns, etc.
Zhang says that searches at sea for lost planes are tremendously difficult. Once the wreckage is found, however, the way the debris is dispersed will give clues as to what might have happened during the flight.
If the airplane hits the ocean in one piece while it remains intact, most likely the debris field would be first small and concentrated in a small diameter of circles. But if you were talking about an in-flight breakup, as some were speculating on the MH370, you would be looking for miles and miles of diameter of a debris field.
The Malaysian Airlines flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing was a Boeing 777-200. A plane air safety experts say has an almost spotless record. There were also no signs of bad weather during the flight. Authorities in Malaysia say they lost contact with the plane about 1 hour after its departure from Kuala Lumpur. Bill Eyde, VOA News, Beijing.
Fear and frustration are growing among family members of passengers on board the Malaysia Airlines flight that disappeared in Southeast Asia. Many are demanding more details from airline officials as the search continues for the missing plane. Shannon Van Sant reports from Beijing.
Families of passengers aboard Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 are vacillating between hope and fear for their loved ones as days pass without details of why the plane vanished early Saturday morning or where it might be. Two-thirds of the passengers were Chinese, and hundreds of family members are waiting in Beijing for answers from airline officials. Many are holed up at a hotel in the city suburbs, where the mood has grown increasingly chaotic as reporters swarm about and press conferences reveal few new details. American Sarah Bajak is also waiting in Beijing for news of her boyfriend, Philip Wood, who was on the flight.
I'm personally not willing to give up hope that there's still a chance that we'll find survivors, that we'll find the plane. There just has to be a chance left.
She says Malaysia Airlines has given her hourly updates, but no further details on the flight. One family member of a passenger from Shanghai complained of the continuing mystery surrounding the flight. There is still no information. My husband's brother was on that plane, the woman said, without giving her name. 239 people and 14 nationalities were on board the plane. Some details have emerged. Radar shows that the plane may have turned back after takeoff. Up to four of the passengers may have been carrying stolen passports. And the Vietnamese government says it found several kilometer-long oil slicks that could indicate a crash into the ocean. Earlier Sunday, Ignatius Ong, a spokesperson from Malaysia Airlines, gave a press conference.
About three to four hours ago, as the time has continued to move on without finding the aircraft, Malaysia Airlines from outside has also informed the family members. We have taken the stand to inform them to expect the worst due to the fact that it has continued. Due to the search and rescue, we couldn't find anything.
Family members described their long wait for news of the aircraft as an excruciating roller coaster ride. The United States, Philippines, Vietnam, Thailand, and China have sent vessels to assist with search and rescue efforts, while the Philippines and Singapore have sent planes that are scouring the region. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
As the full story of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 unfolds, you can stay on top of the latest developments on our program page at voanews.com/daybreakasia, on my Twitter feed at VOA Stevenson, and be sure to like us on Facebook. China's National People's Congress has long been viewed as a rubber stamp body. Critics say that when the Congress is in session, delegates do little but hold meetings, walk around, listen to reports, and file a few complaints. But members of the legislative body, which are holding their 60th session in the capital, Beijing, are looking to change that image. From Hong Kong, Rebecca Valley has more for VOA.
Asked about public perception of lawmakers at a news conference earlier this week, the MPC spokeswoman Fu Ying said it's possible society misunderstands the workings of China's parliament. Fu says that in a year as an MPC representative, she has attended many meetings. She says they are important and very meaningful. As an example, she talked about inspections carried out by delegates in school throughout the country. The survey, she said, was to verify how a 2006 amendment to the compulsory education law was carried out and how money had been spent. In recent years, pressed by a more outspoken public opinion, the Chinese government has tried to portray the image of a functioning parliament, where delegates look like the people they represent and are responsive to the will of their constituency. The number of party officials that make up the majority of lawmakers has gradually decreased in the past few years, and the government has included more seats for migrant workers, farmers, and other representatives of the grassroots. Lin Feng is acting dean at the law school at City University in Hong Kong.
If you look at, for example, different ethnic minority groups and different sectors in the government or in the society, they all have their representatives. But once a motion is put forward there, whether it can actually move forward to achieve something, I'm not sure.
By constitution, the MPC is given a large range of powers, from amending laws and the constitution to approving the state budget and electing top officials. However, many of these powers are exercised in name only. Analysts believe that the real debate over policy details happens ahead of the MPC and within China's bureaucracies and ministries. That is why, they say, some motions have lingered in draft stage for years, only to pass with overwhelming majorities once they're finally presented at the MPC. During the current session, lawmakers will be discussing 68 bills, but the body doesn't expect to pass all of the legislation immediately. Instead, it has given itself a five-year time frame.
The agenda is set more or less for 5 years, and it's rather difficult to insert something additional there.
That doesn't mean that lawmakers are not trying. Rory Truex is a doctoral candidate at Yale's Political Science Department and has looked at the work of delegates in his dissertation. He found that deputies are growing more active and receiving better training.
Currently this year, there's probably about 9,000 different opinions and motions that are being put forth. And that's up from perhaps only a few thousand, maybe 10 years ago.
By looking at the deputies' training material, Truex found that in the hierarchy of their duties, representing the will of the people comes first, while protecting the interests of the party is only second in ranking.
Tacitly, deputies know that in the end, they're supposed to represent the interests of the party first. Occasionally, we will see deputies really take their representative responsibilities very seriously and really challenge the authority of the party.
That has been the case with motions requiring officials to disclose their assets.
It's an interesting example because it shows how occasionally the interests of the party and the interests of the people might conflict. It puts NPC deputies right in the middle.
With rampant corruption in every sector of Chinese society, people's anger often turns around graft among officials who are expected by communist mandate to serve the people. A number of representatives have called for measures to make the government more transparent, including a lawyer from Chongqing who has repeatedly proposed a sunshine bill for 7 years. Analysts believe that while the debate has gained some momentum behind closed doors, leaders are wary of pushing the issue too far into the public eye, and Xi Jinping's administration has punished with jail terms those who do. Rebecca Valli for VOA News in Hong Kong.
China's foreign minister took a strong stand Saturday on China's growing territorial disputes with neighboring nations. Wang Yi emphasized there would be no room for compromise with Japan, and he said China would never accept unreasonable demands from smaller countries, an apparent reference to Southeast Asian nations. Wang, a former ambassador to Japan, made his comments at a news conference on the fourth day of the National People's Congress. China appears to be intensifying a public relations campaign to portray Japan in a negative light. Late last month, the Chinese Communist Party's top legislative body approved two national days of remembrance related to Japan's wars against China in the 20th century. In another recent move, China built a monument to honor a Korean nationalist who assassinated a Japanese colonial ruler of Korea in 1909. For some perspective on these moves, Daybreak Asia's Michael Lippin spoke with Jeffrey Wasserstrom, professor of history at the University of California in Irvine. Wasserstrom says China has several key motives for putting more emphasis on Japan's wartime past.
Well, most recently, it's been linked to the disputes over who controls certain islands that both China and Japan claim. And there have been disputes over islands in those areas for a long time. And actually, some of the tensions between China and Japan as far back as the 1890s were over other islands that both countries claimed. But I think there are a variety of things that make a particular kind of focus on Japanese aggression appealing. One is a knowledge that globally, the great horror of the 20th century is considered German aggression during the Nazi period. And so there's a way in which China can say legitimately that there were absolutely horrible things done on Chinese soil by Japanese troops around the same time that the Nazis were doing horrible things in Europe, and that there's been much less global recognition of the sufferings of Chinese within this setting. So there's been a quite self-conscious effort by the Chinese government to try to raise events like the rape of Nanjing and the massacre of civilians and the rapes in Nanjing in the late 1930s to try to get them seen globally as comparable to the Holocaust, because they just understand that the Holocaust has a special status in the global imagination as the ultimate act of evil of the mid-20th century. And they can see how using the Nanjing massacre as a parallel to that could put them in a particularly advantageous position vis-a-vis Japan and struggles today.
Jeffrey Wasserstrom, professor of history at the University of California in Irvine. One of the struggles between China and Japan centers on a Tokyo shrine that honors Japanese World War II casualties, including convicted war criminals. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe visited the shrine in December, angering China. Daybreak Asia's Michael Lippin asked Mike Kulma, a China analyst at the Asia Society in New York, whether incidents such as that also have fueled China's anti-Japan campaign.
I think it's partly a build-up over time of these kinds of issues, partly at a time when the Japanese prime minister had seemed to make some inroads in relationships with China on the economic front in particular. Then he'd visited the Yasukuni Shrine. A bit of a perhaps slap in the face to the Chinese. Continued contestation of these islands, which we all know is a big issue, but seems to have ramped up over the course of time. And, perhaps just China's overall comfort level with where it is in the world and its role in the region. And what it feels is its capacity to react to what it sees as differences and or provocations by Japan.
What is making China so confident?
Let's take a look over the course of just the last 5 years and the way, I guess, it's come onto the international stage in a much more significant way, particularly one could make the argument out of the global financial crisis, which China seems to have, of course, weathered better than many places. It seems to have begun to play a more significant role on the international scene, in international fora. But certainly, I think, if you think about how their interaction has grown even within the region, you've seen a significant confidence built up in the way that they interact. Sometimes for the positive, sometimes that confidence can come back to haunt the Chinese as well. I think some of the things that you've seen over the course of the last couple of years that are at the very least perceived to be aggressive moves by the Chinese, whether or not it's related to the South China Sea or in various other instances, have come back to bite China a little bit. So these actions are suggested, I think, of a confidence within China about their ability to make such moves. But at the same time, they're now, I think, being perceived at times as more aggressive than not.
Mike Kulma, Executive Director of Global Leadership Initiatives at the Asia Society in New York, speaking with Daybreak Asia's Michael Lippin. Forest fires in the Indonesian province of Riau continue to rage a week after a state of emergency was declared. From Jakarta, Kate Lamb reports on the central government's efforts to quell the flames and the thorny issue of transnational haze.
Over the past week, the government has employed water-bombing planes and cloud seeding in an attempt to control the fires roaring through Riau's forests. But a reported 8,000 hectares remains engulfed in flames. Speaking from Riau's capital of Pekanbaru, Sutopo Nugroho, the spokesperson for the National Disaster Mitigation Agency, says conditions could worsen. Nugroho says that in the lead-up to summer, the prolonged dry spell could intensify the blazes. Without sufficient action to extinguish the current fires, he said, these conditions are also likely to have a negative impact on food and energy supplies. Over the past week, huge swathes of land have been destroyed, flights have been delayed and schools shut down. The levels of haze have also caused a spike in respiratory illnesses. Riau province on the island of Sumatra is a major palm oil producer, and despite a zero burning policy, forested land is regularly cleared through illegal burning to make way for new plantations. Yuyun Indradi from Greenpeace Indonesia says forest fires in Riau are a recurring problem and one the government has failed to seriously crack down on.
Actually, to monitor the hotspot is fairly easy. It is because there's a free platform to monitoring the hotspot that the government can use. But again, it's a matter of a political will and their seriousness to deal with this.
Indradi says hotspots in Riau were first identified in satellite images this January, but failed to prompt immediate government action. Annual forest fires on the islands of Sumatra and Kalimantan are becoming increasingly problematic for Indonesia and also its neighbours. Palm oil and timber plantations here are also operated by Malaysia and Singapore-based companies, and Indonesia has been reluctant to take all the blame. But last year, Indonesia's president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, was forced to apologise to neighbouring Singapore and Malaysia after they were blanketed by thick haze and smog. A shift in wind direction, which usually occurs now at the end of monsoon season, is likely to see the smog looming again. After facing nearly $1 billion in financial losses from the haze last year, Singapore has decided to take matters into its own hands, drafting its own bill on transboundary haze. If passed, the proposed law will allow the government to fine companies responsible for the fires and ensuing haze up to $300,000. Climate change and sustainability specialist Fitrian Adiansha says the proposed law could help tackle the source of the problem.
If you just catch those that trigger fires on the ground, mostly they are, if not poor farmers, they are poor contractors or something like that. If you get really companies or whoever that's financing them, it will be providing good signals to the market as well as to sector itself that this is a serious issue. It needs to be addressed seriously by governments involved in the region.
The bill targets foreign companies as well as those based in Singapore. Indonesia is the only country yet to sign the ASEAN Treaty on Transboundary Haze, a legally binding agreement that obligates countries to cooperate on open burning and monitoring prevention efforts. For VOA News, this is Kate Lamb, Jakarta.
Well, it's Monday, and we want to present the results of our weekly online poll. In the history of the Oscars, an Asian film has never won Best Picture. Does it matter that Asian filmmakers have not brought home any Hollywood Film Awards? Most of our audience who responded said no, about 57%. Nearly 38% felt it is important to take home the coveted Golden Statue, while about 5% were not sure. Well, thanks to all who voted, and be sure to stop by our program page at voanews.com/DaybreakAsia for much more beyond our time together here each day on Daybreak Asia. Topping our poll for the latest world news is Steve Norman. He's next with International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for listening today on Daybreak Asia.
For listeners in China, there's a new Chinese language iPhone application from VOA. Simply go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese, and then look for VOA News Chinese Edition. With this application, you can get the latest news and radio and TV.